Our speaker this evening is Robert Rosenthal, an old friend to most of you, and certainly no stranger to any of you, who will be speaking, I'm sure, as truthfully as he can, on the interesting story of the John Carrar Library in Chicago. It's a great pleasure to welcome him here tonight.
Well, thank you, Terry. You're as gracious as ever. And I shall try to tell the truth. In fact, nothing but the truth this evening. The paper I'm about to give you, it's really an address or a gloss on a paper, concerns a theft that occurred in a institution in Chicago named the John Carrar Library. I'll state a few introductory remarks before I get to the presentation itself. I should say something about the Carrar Library, because the context of, it's exceedingly important to understand the context and the history of that institution to really have a full understanding and a sympathetic understanding of the nature of the event, which was a theft. I think the same sympathy and understanding needs to be applied to certain other characters in this tale. And so I want to make sure that you're fully informed of the history and the background. Not fully informed, but reasonably informed. The John Carrar Library was one of a number of private institutions that resulted in, in rather magnificent gifts to the city at the end of the 19th century in Chicago, and the result of the rise of that city following the Chicago fire and the Civil War, when a great deal of capital was accumulated. John Carrar was a railroadman, made a great deal of money selling supplies to the railroads which were stretching westward. It was founded after his death by bequest in 1895. A few years following the founding of the Carrar Library, and in a very early attempt to rationalize the collecting policies, if you will, of libraries in Chicago, the Carrar Library decided to emphasize the collection of science, medicine, and technology, while the Newberry, over a period of time, eventually became the institution which specialized in the humanities. It had a distinguished staff and, over the years, accumulated a distinguished collection, which grew to approximately 1 million volumes. Plus, it'd take a couple of hundred thousand. More recently, following World War II, that library began to lose its constituencies. And confusion, in my opinion, began to appear about its mission within that city. This had a great deal of implications, many implications for its support, at least on the old basis, which was private philanthropy, and certainly pointed out the inadequacy of its endowment. Not an uncommon condition for many private institutions and private libraries today. By the early 1950s, I think it's fair to say that the institution had begun a rather slow decline. And it moved in the 1950s as a form of consolidation to the campus of the Illinois Institute of Technology, a technical school on the Chicago South Side. Previously, it had occupied a skyscraper at the corner of Michigan and Randolph Street, which is in the center, practically in the very center of the city, so it might have been so it could be close to its constituency, that is, practicing physicians, the engineering and scientific community, which was centered in the Chicago Loop. A whole series of actions, administrative actions, were taken, and I think it's important for you to understand this, to rationalize the institution. It had a large, included in its definition of science with the social sciences, it sold many of its very important collections in the social sciences in the 1950s. Its great collection on the history of economics, for example, was sold to the University of Kansas. It's had a great collection on women's studies, which I think was dispersed, some of it going to Kansas. There were a whole series of internal innovations and changes in the attempt to rationalize the administration and care and growth of that collection. There was the relationship with the Illinois Institute of Technology is a complex one, and essentially the Quirar moved out to the campus, the IIT campus, to perform services, and they were reimbursed by the trustees of the IIT to perform these services for its students, as well as carry on the larger responsibility it had to the city, to the region, and it even and its national programs, and the Quirar did have a number of national programs. Anyway, that's the background so far as the physical context of this theft is concerned. I'd like to say a few things about the thievery of books, which is a topic of increasing concern both for librarians and scholars and administrators. And as you all know, there's been a great rash of thefts in recent years. Certainly one reason has been we've all become more conscious of them. And there hasn't been, a major library, at least university library, in the country that I can think of that has wholly escaped this type of depredation. Harvard, Yale, Berkeley, Illinois. University of Chicago, but I can't remember a theft at Chicago. And that may be out of our ignorance, I should say, more than any direct knowledge. But most of the larger libraries have been victimized. Now, there's a special problem about the susceptibility of books, and one of the problems regarding the thievery of books is just the sheer number of books and the similarity that appears to exist between books. It's unlike a painting, which in itself is unique and identifiable. It's hard, I realize I'm speaking to people who are intimate, by and large, with books, but most people make it hard to make certain types of distinctions among books. At any rate, in any case, individual books have multiple copies, that's printed books, and that's the whole purpose of the process of printing. And to make distinctions, it gets into highly technical areas very quickly. So problems of identification become a matter of expertise and a consciousness about that object. Another problem with thefts is the cost of security in the face of other demands on a essentially passive institution. And libraries are, to my mind, relatively passive institutions. And the need to remain vital, it finds it's very difficult to justify the cost of security when there's so many other demands on libraries for salaries, for growth, and for other ways of remaining vital. In other words, security is essentially non-productive effort. Doesn't produce anything. And of course, there's the issue of the increasing awareness in the marketplace of the value of books, especially as the availability of other objects of value, jewelry, paintings, become increasingly scarce. Well, these objects become, as these other objects disappear, and that's being transferred to books as something venerable, desirable, aesthetically pleasing, however one wants to rationalize it. Let me say a few things about the theft at the Queer Art. There are a few special characteristics of this caper. One is, and what makes it distinct? One is the number and the importance of the books involved. Another is the rather curious way in which the theft was eventually discovered. Most interestingly, perhaps, for this evening, is the voluminous and detailed documentation that exists for all aspects of the theft. And perhaps in the longer range, the implications it has for certain moral and managerial aspects of our work with books. Indirectly, the implications it has for the changing nature of libraries. Now, in presenting my more direct remarks this evening, and in presenting the whole story of this incident, I've divided it into three parts. One is looking at it from the viewpoint of the thief and describing his relationship with the institution, his methods, and how he eventually disposed of the loot. That's the introduction to the caper. The second part is devoted to the detection of the crime and the apprehension of the culprit. And the third part is the attempts to retrieve the books. Now, this evening, I will emphasize, for lack of time, the first and second portions of the of the scenario. The third part is fully documented in a transcript, most of it, that was taken during the court proceedings, in which the trustees of the Currer Library sued a firm, John Howell Books of San Francisco, for compensation or the retrieval of books which that firm sold unwittingly, but nevertheless was the property of the Currer trustees. Now, I want to give you some very basic facts about the theft, and there are two things you need to know. One, as the institution went into decline by the late 70s, there was discussion between the trustees of the Currer Library, quite distinct from the trustees of the Illinois Institute of Technology, but the trustees of the Currer Library, to see if it could merge with a more hospitable institution. Discussions took place with a number of libraries and universities. And by April of 1981, an agreement to merge was signed by the trustees of the University of Chicago and the trustees of the John Currer Library. It's at this point, in April of 1981, that the university began to assume responsibility for some of the books in the John Currer Library, although the John Currer trustees were still the legal held legal responsibility or fiduciary responsibility for that institution and its endowment and its and its assets. At the time that the merger took place, there was an immediate insistence on my part, once it became clear that the rare books needed to be rehoused, that an inventory be made. And I will get into that matter sooner or later. The whole process of inventorying that collection was exceedingly complex. It raised a lot of questions about delay, and I will get into this issue of the nature of assessing a large, complex body of books in a few moments. The objective of this inventory was relatively simple. It was just a matter of establishing what was the university assuming responsibility for, what was there and what was not there, according to the record. The thief, incidentally, to give you some chronology, was apprehended in January of 1983. A trial occurred about a year later. He was sent to the jug for 2 years. He plea bargained, and the nature of that plea bargaining was rather interesting, not without bibliographical overtones, or undertones in this case. One other thing that came out of this merger was the creation of a new building on the University of Chicago campus. That is, the John Cuellar Library was rebuilt, in effect, and it is now the Consolidated Science Library on the University of Chicago campus. It cost the university, I think, $25 million to effect this merger. This money did not come from the endowment of the Cuellar Library. The present state of affairs, roughly, is that the University of Chicago Library is in a grand process of assimilating 700,000 or 800,000 volumes. It's something that's going to occupy my library for the next decade, one way or the other, given the difference in the classification systems and meshing the two collections. Nevertheless, it creates a grand science facility on our campus, and one that has long been overdue. Now, I'd like to say a few things about the theft, and what I'm doing is giving you here some of the reverse information. You're getting information that we only found out after many months and years of working with those books, and I want to give you some of the basic information right from the start. The theft, there were 500 and... The thefts began, incidentally, in 1976 and continued over roughly a 5 to 6 year period. There were 572 books or titles stolen from a total of 27,400 rare books. Just in the use of that terminology of what constitutes a book, and I'm sure you're all familiar with this problem, a book or a title or volume or bibliographical unit was the bane of our existence as we had to get into this vast body of material. The market value of the individual titles stolen by the theft ranged from a few dollars to an individual volume worth $80,000, according to current fair market value. The thief realized a total of $247,000 from the sale of 226 books, all of which were sold to a single bookseller, John Howell Books Incorporated of San Francisco. Of the 572 books stolen, 396 were ultimately returned and are in our possession as of this date. 176 have been irretrievably lost. Lost in the sense that for a variety of reasons, economic, bibliographical, that we have chosen not to pursue those books. That can all be explained. And it's a matter of open record. A little more than 300 of the 572 books, a little more than 300, were retrieved by the FBI when it apprehended the thief. The remaining books, I think about 125 or so, were in the possession of the bookseller at the time that the theft was uncovered, or have been retrieved from customers of that, who bought the books from that bookseller. Now that's the background, and what I've tried to do is give you some of the very essential facts. Now I want to take you into the rare book vault of the John Crerar Library and give you a feeling for what the thief saw when he walked into that area. And I'm going to, the rest of the presentation, until the conclusion, will be largely slides. Now, is this right, Terry? This is a typical some of the categories, well, the categories were not mutually exclusive, so there was overlap. There was a great deal of material in the vault that was non-rare book material. It was contaminated, in other words. It was used partially as a storeroom for extraneous material. Another important lesson in terms of maintenance of collection. Well, anyway, here's this thief. I should say something about him. He's a man about 50 years old. He represented a advertising firm in Chicago that specialized in money had a group of associates from the industrial area that supported the library through grants and were given access or use privileges for its collection. And of course the advertising firm was always looking for photographs, engravings, illustrations for its ads. And this man befriended one of the members of the staff, who had been on the staff for 40 years, and was ultimately given access to the vault. As a matter of accommodation, a matter of friendship, and the difficulty of responding to the requirements of one of the associated firms who were paying money to the library. So there was a pressure to comply, to perhaps even to acquiesce from that. At any rate, there was a thief who had no previous knowledge of books, except he knew a good thing when he saw it. And he would come in and see books with these numbers. Up here, incidentally, sticking up from the top of the volume, is a inventory number, which was eventually put into every book. And the basis for the university to gain control over those collections. How do I do next? Upper left hand button. Here's another type of marking. Very typical was a gilt stamping on the lower left hand corner of, in this case, a pair of binding. I'm going to go very quickly here. Here's another type of stamping. Leather and end with the Skyver label here. Another method, call number on the backboard. There is a another call number, and here the HAR is one of the author collections, one of the 50 or 60 collections that were there, and that's a author collection for William Harvey. Here is a series of book plates. Many of the books, most of the books were plated, but there were 7,000 books in that collection of the 27,000 that were not cataloged at all, and some had no markings of any kind. Here, it's a collection, a very distinguished collection on the history of medicine, that was at one time donated to the Newbery and eventually moved to the Cura. Here is a well-known ornithological work with a earlier stamp from a library in Albany, New York. This is, a more typical, ordinary book. I'm not even sure it's a rare book by some measure that was in that collection, which the thief would have immediately seen as a problem because he was concerned with those perforations, and that's very important. And here it covers part of the text on the title page, and in fact, the thief was very ingenious, and there was at one point where he attempted to replace the dots. really hardworking. But he tried to fill every one of those dots on one book. And here's the old Newbery. Here again is a typical book that the thief would come across. And I only picked this out because it's a very unusual volume. You see the mark of ownership. Again, a book I had never even seen before that turned up in Goldschmidt's last catalog, and I just said, I bet that's in the Cura collection. A wonderful book on veneers. here's the book that where the thief obviously ran into a problem. He's familiar with that up there, but what do you do with the with inscription? Again, the typical way the pair are marked, its call number was on the first leaf following the title page with the accession number. There are two accession numbers, two numbers there. I'm not sure what both of them mean, but one is certainly the regular accession number. This is the call number. Here is the former ownership of the British Museum. And that's not untypical. The plates, of course, were a problem, and many of the plates were stamped on the verso. I think the net here is some other rather attractive plates from a book on ornithology. I just threw these in. Lovely, exquisite volumes running throughout this collection. And some others, it's a big one. I just, these would give you some idea of some of the plate books. They're rather pulled out some unusual. And then here's a, this book actually is one of the books that were stolen. I think you really didn't know what to do with it. It's one of the German technical books at the turn of the century, that flat books that, as you can see, open up for use, for any of you who have not seen books of this kind. In fact, the are specialized in books of this kind. So this is the same. And you go deeper and deeper into the. There are also drawings. These are original drawings here that were part of the collection, all of which was accessible to the thief. And in fact, many of the smaller collections of this kind were not even inventoried. So there were problems. And that cannot be denied. Color plate, chromolithic photography. I just throw these in to give you some idea of the range of that collection. And obviously these are fairly. Now, that the thief had sized up the situation and the physical condition of those books, he had to decide whether it was going to be worth removing marks of ownership. And when his home, he lived in Milwaukee, incidentally, it was raided. They also, the FBI, packed up and preserved all his equipment as well as the contents of his waste baskets as they found it. And here you see his equipment, the sandpaper, hammer paper, knives, scrapers, racers, bleaching compound, tissue, gloves. I don't think, here's some tissue we have. You see, there's a lot of the original tissue that he used to absorb the bleach. We don't know what this metal thing is. We thought it might be to warm a vial of bleach or to keep the door open. Never figured that out. And we're not about to ask. Now the thief, the wonderful thing about this man, he was terribly fastidious. The first thing he did when he stole a book, he Xeroxed the title page. And we have the Xeroxes of the title pages where he's writing the instructions to himself. This is his inventory number. And that was the number that he kept control of his collection. crucial later on when he started to argue with the bookseller over his accounts. And his accounts with Warren Howell were the bane of poor Warren's existence during the last year of his life. I can go into details about some of the negotiations that went on. All the ledgers have been saved on the thief side, and the ones on Warren Howell's side have been saved. Nothing was hidden. There's always been the suggestion that the full stories never come out. Well, the full story is in the record, and there may be something hidden about the motive. Book as it was rebound by Warren Howell. The thief also kept notes on the back side of his calendar pad, although this is not a clue to the exact chronology of when particular books were handled. He saved old calendars. Here he's saying that it has a perforated title page, hole that he wants to do something, unprinted part, could be repaired, perforation removed and saved, book plate removed, pencil marks, upper right corner, verso, first upper right-hand corner of that page of G, of the title page of G, tore out. And this is the note and the folded sheet that he put this little piece of paper in. And here's the book where he tore out the perforation right in here. In this case, it was just JCL, a John Crear Library. And all of that, this is the black, obviously, here's another typical method that he used where I showed you that the call number was put down here. He erased it, and there's a wearing away of the fiber, paper fiber, where a call number or accession number. Now, from the viewpoint of the bookseller, and I'm not here to make a case one way or the other, the real issue here is when and how. How much should the bookseller have known? That's a basic question. How much should a bookseller know? It's a fundamental question in this case. When every one bit of information, given the idiosyncratic use and ownership of books, when, in other words, does a pattern develop? And when should the bookseller or anyone else, a librarian, for that matter, have perceived a pattern developing? When any one bit of information may be a sport or irrelevant. Here is some attempt to bleach out some writing on the are the notes that the thief kept on this particular book. I didn't show you the spine, but he had on the call number was on the spine, clean title page for a Xerox, JCL, lower left corner of the front cover, removed. Then on the bottom of leaf 3, Roman 3, which is the leaf following the title page, he says, on that, see if I go back here, he says that it said director's room, which is the old name for the rare book room, as in most libraries when they began. This book has been in the library for many years. That was the director's room, and there was a number on the bottom which he removed, and that he also removed a book plate, pasted inside the front cover. So that's what happened to that particular book, and we're able to verify. The question is, of course, how would the bookseller know? That's a constant question at all. Now here is a book that he walked out with, and this is a very special problem. This is the first edition of the Carnegie. But it's also a censored copy with the annotations of the censor. Now, this is a rather interesting instance because if any of you working in this field will know that there is one gentleman in the field, Owen Gingrich, who's devoted a great deal of time to the study of it. In any case, we're looking at it, and I should say that Warren Howell contacted Owen Gingrich very early on, and that book came into his possession. The real issue here, is from the thief's point of view, is what is he going to do with that book? He's looking at it. He knows the importance. He's no dummy. He can read the Dictionary of Science, Scientific Biography, as well as anyone else, and know that an annotated copy of Copernicus is a hot book, a good book to sell. But would people know about that annotation? He didn't know. In fact, the library obviously knew what. Here's a Xerox that the library had made years ago of the same page. This was in the library record. Here are some sources of information that the thief conveniently acquired. One, he pulls the card cap. Pulls the card. Of course, that doesn't hurt in covering up the thief. Here's a exhibit card, which was exhibit caption card that was left in the book. And there are the notes. He knows about the National Union catalog. He's running fast. He's no dummy. There's no way I could have removed the censor ink that came from the Inquisition. And I tried all kinds of solvents, all variations, and could not remove that. There were a lot of stamps of previous owners that apparently had terrible ink, which meant ink he couldn't remove. And you could obliterate some of them, but in many cases, not remove. That was his statement about his encounter with this particular book. But you can see now, you're getting into his process of getting information, covering his tracks. Here's a book that was recovered in the state of being de-inked, and it was recovered with the residue of the bleach. And we photographed it just because I know Paul Mackey approved of us keeping that tissue in there. And, but you can see what he was doing. He was removing something right here. This is the, there it is. It doesn't get on to the next leaf. Here's another book. Again, patterns develop. Here's an, this is all going through the same, going to down the same route. What do you make of that? Well, I should go back and to say here is a tear. Again, here's the Gilbert first edition of it, with the bleach. I'll go through this relatively quickly. You've seen that. Here is another thing with this removed, this corner removed. In fact, I think the bookseller had that corner repaired. Problem. The question was, and the don't think the bookseller didn't ask, where did these books come from? Because among these books was also a first edition of one of the great book that history of medicine, at least as book collecting ethos has it today, William Harvey's De Motu Cordis. Where did these books come from? Was the question, and that was put to the people. He said, in effect, that they were inherited through his wife, whom he met in Germany while he was serving in the army, that they had been smuggled out and come into his possession through his wife, from whom he had been divorced. Could happen. East Germany raises some interesting questions, but it could happen. The whole question of transfer of ownership or transfer of title of books is a rather interesting one, and a rather interesting legal issue, and how it's done today. In any case, among the books that were sold to the bookseller was one Singer on the leaf. And for those of you in the audience who don't recall that name, very unusual medicine and science, whose collection was dispersed in the, think, late 50s after his death. And after the books presumably came from East Germany. How did that book get into that collection? Presumably from East Germany. There were other issues there. Among the things the bookseller acquired was a collection of autographs, some of which were dated after the date that they presumed they documented. There were other patterns in those autographs of letters of Luther Burbank, some American scientists. I think, I don't know if Adlai Stevenson was even represented, but something of that just was out of place. Now, anything can happen with the movement of books. We all know that. And very, very often, very strange things happen. But there's a pattern. And there's a physical evidence of the time. Now, here's another case. Now, this was one book that was brought up in the trial later on, where it's in a velveteen binding. And the spine is rough. Why would the research and work with this case, we have a history of book plating at the Pajonkara Library, and we know the dimensions as the book plate, size of the book plate, changed over time. This became crucial evidence in identifying a number of books, just the, to the millimeter, the dimension of the book plate. Here, this is the same book. Short period, the Currer Library was Xeroxing pages 199 in the upper right-hand corner. It was a strange attempt to consolidate or become zealous in their marking of books. So they decided page 99, or at least page 99, would be zero, would be perforated in the top corner. But whoever did it put two leaves into the perforated. And two leaves were, and the thief collated the book. And he and he removed it. Here's another book, very famous one, up the right hand corner. Here in the same volume, a plate to get some idea of the size. We didn't put in rulers and all of this, obviously. Just to show you on the back of the plate. Now the question is, how careful does anyone look at a book? And who should be careful? And why? Here are his working notes. He had a rather cute, you know, he had to remind himself that this was Kepler. Zealous and translating Roman numbers. But you can see what he's saying is the top is torn, working copy. Old torn copy needs much work to restore foxing. Now he knows what foxing is. Needs rebinding. And then some wormholes. Here is some of the sources of this information. Just you've seen these before. These are captions from the exhibit. These are his notes. Which also tell where he saw the book. He had to, he didn't perhaps understand the call numbers, but he says it's, this is the designation of the shelf. It's the sixth one in the third down, which is the location of where that would have been on the shelf. But these are some of his notes. Here's some more notes on the Keplers and Galileos that he, some of which he took, some of which he didn't have time to take. Now here's something that was, the search was zealous. Let me tell you one interesting story about a book on circulation of the blood. And we had to verify that the Currer owned the book. And very often we could not do it. The acquisition records were not complete. And we had no familiarity with that library's methods. So we went all over the place looking for dealer's catalogs. And up at the Houghton, we found a catalog of a book on the circulation from a local dealer in New York City, incidentally, a very distinguished one, who sold the book to the Currer in 1950. And we were able to establish that. The books were sold to Warren Howell. Warren Howell sold it back to the dealer in New York City, who sold it originally to the Currer. And the dealer, in his write-up the second time around, said, "Very rare. I have seen only one other copy in my life." It was the same. Same copy, and this was just established by digging very deeply into the provenance of the book. Well, here's Warren Howell's, one of his catalogs. It's called Bookman, his periodic method descriptions. And we were reading through all his tablets. You can imagine, this was after the fact, I should say. I'm going to stop in a moment and just tell you how the thief was apprehended, because that was a great story. But I just wanted to take you through this. And this book had been declared lost at the Courier. Well, I'm going to shoot these very quickly now. I realize I'm overstating. Here's the inventory number sheet. Every book, our problem with that inventory was terribly complex. We had to establish, there was no shelf list, incidentally, for those 27. We didn't even know what was there in that room, except there were a lot of books, some of which were cataloged, uncataloged, and they were in about 50 categories. And how did you establish what was supposed to be in that, what was in that room, what was supposed to be in that room, and what was supposed to be in that room that was not in that room? That was the essential. Anyway, each one got an inventory number, so we at least knew, as of a particular date, whether anything was missing. And that established our responsibility. When the numbering stopped, that was the end of it. That's what physically and legally we were going to be responsible for. Best thing I ever did. Here is the case of that book we saw earlier on. Here we created an inventory sheet for each book. We Xeroxed every title. Because this number up here, the only thing it would tell you is if a book was missing. It wouldn't tell you what book was missing, because there was no shelf list. So we had to Xerox the title pages of 27,400 volumes, reduce them to this form, which is 8.5 by 11. Then, as you know, I hope you're sympathetic to this problem. Then establish what the main entry. Call number, and then look through 400,000 sheets, which were Xeroxes of the shelf list, the general shelf list, and remembering those 50 or 60 categories, pull out copies of all those cards, which essentially were 27,400 titles that belonged to that list. It was really a monumental task. The best thing, of course, they got the great opportunity to handle these books intensively. Well, we're working on these now. I should say these sheets have functioned in a variety of ways. We have one sheet like this that is essentially the shelf list. We've Xeroxed it in another sequence. It's become the catalog because we now have a series of files. Binders by main entry, and then we've done one chronologically. So we were able to report very quickly our ESTC holdings, at least for Curl ESTC. But this was something we developed. It might be interesting. Here is the detail. This is a shelf list card where our inventory number is up here now, and we had to transfer this information back and forth from that sheet. Now this is the volume, and I'm going to conclude in a few moments. Let me just show you this. This is on a manuscript of Nicholas de Cusa that was instrumental in finding the thief, locating it. And it's one, I think, the only manuscript in effect that he stole. And I'll tell you about that in a moment. It'll take about 5 more minutes. Here is the description of that manuscript from Goldschmidt, E.P. Goldschmidt. I think it's 1927. A description of that manuscript. Here are the cards. getting so much information from different sources about each missing book. Each book had its dossier, 400 to 395. We developed this trade sheet, which is really worth some detail, but I won't be able to go into it now, which goes into the types of evidence that we were uncovering from various accounts of John Howell books, from Xeroxes, from the Clearar Library sources. We were checking all of these variety of possibilities of places to check, and then we had to put our comments down on each physical copy. For the trial, that is, when we tried to recover the book, to make a case that that individual copy was the Clearar copy, and not another copy that the thief might have stolen or that he might have come elsewhere, we developed this form called the evidence sheet. And there was historical evidence that is historical evidence related to the particular copy, Clearar copy, where it existed in various catalogs. The evidence that came from the thief, and then physical evidence of the object itself. And these were all lined up on the sheet and then collated as we had to, and synthesized as we had to make our case. I'm sorry that there isn't time. I don't want to bore you longer than I have to on what all this really means, because once you go back and show exactly what happened in greater detail on each book. But these numbers, for example, are in the dossier. Each item had a dossier on item. So we go right to the particular documentation quickly. Well, I think those are all the slides right there. Let me conclude now. It's really not the conclusion, thank you, but an essential part of the tale. And that is how the thief was apprehended. Now, there had been indications, even before the university came into the picture, that something was amiss or awry, but amiss is perhaps a little better, in that collection. There had been efforts to that did not include some of its principal books, including the De Motu Cordis. Efforts were being made to locate this copy. You can imagine the confusion that the then librarians had in this area. Most of the clerical help had no knowledge of books, and in fact were uneducated. So there was some indication when the university entered the picture that may indeed be some important books missing. But we didn't know how many. We knew a few titles. And that was one of the reasons for this massive inventory process. In the summer of 1982, remember the merger took place in the spring of 81. And by the time we were just completing the inventory, a letter was received, quite by chance, from a very eminent scholar named Raymond Kleblonski, a medievalist who had devoted much of his study to the works of a man, German late medievalist philosopher named Nicholas de Cusa, been, in fact, publishing the collected works of the said Nicholas. In the early 50s, he had requested a manuscript of Nicholas de Cusa that he knew was in the Currer Library. In fact, we have the letter that E.P. Goldschmidt informed Kleblansky in 1934 that that manuscript was indeed, he had sold it in 1926 or 27 to the Currer. It wasn't until after the war then that Kleblansky turns up and says, where is the manuscript? They couldn't find the manuscript. Kleblansky writes again, could not find the manuscript. In the summer, late summer of 82, a letter comes from Mr. Kleblansky, or Professor Kleblansky, who teaches at Oxford, incidentally, saying, I have had the greatest luck. I found your that manuscript in the Staatsbibliothek in Berlin. Your manuscript is now in Berlin. The one you didn't let me see. And if you want to know more about it, read the introduction to volume 11 of my Opera Omnia. Or his Opera Omnia, which I... In any case, the librarian at that time forwards the letter to me with the question, what should I do about it? Well, what should we do about it? Well, that was one of the quickest decisions I ever made. I said, get me volume 11. And sure enough, it was in the bindery, incidentally. That didn't stop the book from appearing very, very quickly. And there in Latin, in the introduction, was the history of that manuscript. Understood it, saying in effect that he had heard the manuscript had been in the Currer. It had been sold by Jacques Rosenthal in Munich in 1926 to E.P. Goldschmidt in London. The next year it had been sold to the John Currer Library, that he had made requests for this manuscript which were not forthcoming, but in 1979 in this annual report of the Staatsbibliothek he had seen that the manuscript was in the Staatsbibliothek, and indeed he had seen it and used it there, and they had acquired it from a very eminent American bookseller in San Francisco, the one and only Barney Rosenthal. The question was put to me, what do we do about it? I said, I know what you do about it. You write Barney Rosenthal. Where he got that manuscript. Now, you have to understand that some of these people had not been involved in anything like this before. Not that I had been involved, but it was quite obvious that what the question was. A letter was sent to Barney Rosenthal. I had drafted it. The librarian sent it out. Just asked him what the source of his manuscript. Barney, who's a very close friend of mine, sent a letter back essentially saying he bought it from a very reputable bookseller. It was on the up and up. Thank you very much. And the letter was then forwarded to me, Barney's reply, essentially. And the librarian said, well, I guess that finishes it. I said, no, it doesn't. At this time, there was tremendous pressure building up on us from a variety of sources to produce a rare booklet of books that were missing. And we were putting all of this into the computer because we were adding books. Remember, there were 50 categories, and books turned up all over the place because of misfiling and misunderstanding because of the general conditions that existed. In any case, there was pressure to reveal. And I said, it cannot be revealed if you want a definitive list until the record is completed. And we were just about 90% complete about at this point in our checking. And a trustee of the Currer, also a bookseller, at this point called Barney. Barney immediately called Warren Howell. Warren, who really had nothing to hide, told Barney, and word came back. I don't recall the exact route. That's irrelevant, unimportant. That it was purchased from a man named Putnam, from Milwaukee. Bought a great many books from this gentleman from Milwaukee, and he sold it. Warren had purchased them and sold it to Barney because it was not Warren Howell's type of book, and it was quite obviously Barney Rosenthal's manuscript, type of manuscript. And from the revelation of this name coming back through San Francisco, through the two books of, and into the records of the Currer, the name was immediately linked with a man named Joseph Putnam, who used the name Putnam, P-U-T-N-A, which was his real name, and who was the gentleman who, it turns out, was actually the thief. And the FBI was immediately notified at this point, and Mr. Putnam's residence in suburban Milwaukee was raided, and 325 volumes and all that paraphernalia were located there. The next problem, and that's how the case was busted wide open. The real next issue became one of restitution for the important books that had been sold. As I told you, there, the thief had profited by approximately $250,000. He had spent all of this money, most of it. He had no assets except for an automobile and, I guess, this house, modest house in Milwaukee. How restitution would be made. Warren Howell was caught in the middle of this. He was very much a party to it in the sense that he handled property that was stolen. A court litigation was instituted by the trustees of the Currer Library, since it was still their responsibility, versus John Howell Books. And this went to trial last spring in Chicago. And in the end, I think it was settled out of court. It was settled out of court, and I think favorably to the benefit of Warren Howell's estate. He died, as you may have known, in the course of this. I think with great anguish. I think it's unfortunate that he had to had a very important career as a bookseller, and it was tragic that his end had to come with this case unresolved. I think we did well, and I think everyone did well in this in terms of Warren's memory. It says a great deal, not so much about him as a, I would say, as a, and I'm speaking as a friend, as a bookseller. I think there was no question of his honorable intentions. It may say more about his very vital character and his need to fulfill certain very deep urges in the possession and sale of books and what it really did for his sense of vitality. He was a very vital man. I think the university came out very well on this. We, of course, have plenty of books. I mean, we've got 27,400 volumes that are going to keep us busy digesting for many years to come. We've been fortunate enough to get some rather interesting funding to work with those books, to integrate them, and I think to make them useful not only to our own scholarly community, but the whole country. This incident, I'm sorry that I have not had to give short shrift to some of the legal issues that came up during the trial in terms of the identification of books and how do you know a book is the book you're talking about. And the nature of library cataloging and identification. There are underlying themes here of responsibility, obviously, professional as well as fiduciary responsibility. But all I can say is the running of institutions are very complex and that libraries are very complex.